Dr. Larry Hurtado. He's the Emeritus Professor of New Testament Language, Literature, and Theology at the University of Edinburgh. He recently released a book, very recently, entitled Destroyer of the Gods. A fascinating read, actually, because what is he is examining is the explosion of early Christianity, why so many people became Christians. And what he's doing is trying to show that this happened despite the fact that within the Roman Empire, everybody viewed Christianity as antisocial, as odd, and as irrational. And Hurtado seeks to demonstrate as a historian that Christianity grew because of its distinctives. Its distinctives in its beliefs, in its practices. And he shows it in many different areas, but he particularly draws it out in the Christian distinctives on things like human rights, social justice, and compassion for the poor. Now, of course, today, we take it for granted in our culture that all human beings deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. But what Hurtado shows in this book is that the only reason you think that way today is because you are the heir of a culture that was changed. The Roman Empire did not think this way. In the history of the world, people didn't usually think this way. And you are the heir of a Christian tradition that has come down. You are the heir of the radical ideas that Christianity introduced to the world. Let me give you a few examples. For instance, the Romans regularly practiced infanticide. Infanticide is the discarding of unwanted newborn babies, sometimes in alleys, sometimes on trash heaps. Of course, the unwanted child would then die of exposure, or they would be picked up and they would be raised to become slaves or prostitutes within the brothels. The early Christians utterly condemned this practice. One of the ways that we see this is they picked up the babies. They arranged for nursing mothers to come to care for them. They adopted these babies into their own families. They changed the very way that society thought about newborn babies so that today we have inherited this tradition where we would condemn the exposing of an unwanted newborn. It's the heir of a Christian tradition. Another example. In the Roman era, it was also common and accepted practice for adult men to have sexual relationships with young adolescents and even younger boys. If you do any reading in ancient history, you'll see this is so common. I've done a lot of reading, for instance, in Plato, and it's rather shocking as you're reading along and you're reading Plato, and then suddenly he'll start to refer to this kind of relationship of a man to a boy, and he brings it out of nowhere like it's perfectly common accepted practice, and then he'll even promote it as being one of the highest forms of love. A man's relationship, a sexual relationship with a boy, was celebrated, for instance, in songs. It was an accepted practice. Christians not only condemned this, they actually changed the very way that it was referred to. The Greek word that was referred to in ancient times was paiderastis, which simply means a lover of children, a sexual lover of children. It's, of course, a neutral term. It doesn't say whether it's good or bad, and that's the Greek term that was used within the Roman Empire. Christians coined a brand new term for it that took over this term. They did not call it paiderastis. They called it paedophthoros, which means a destroyer, corrupter, or seducer of children. The early Christians changed the very way that Western culture thinks about sexual relationships between men and boys. Third example, the Romans also cared very little for their poor. Christians, on the other hand, gave themselves to the care of the poor. Listen to this astounding quote from the emperor himself, from Emperor Julian, who came along and he wanted to stop the progression of Christianity. So he tried all kinds of things, and one of the things that he tried was to get the Roman people to start caring for their own poor. It didn't work. And so one day, Julian was writing a letter to one of his friends, and he writes of the Christians these words: "Their success lies in their charity to strangers. The impious Galileans," that is, the Christians, support both their own poor and ours as well. What a statement from the most powerful man in the ancient world of that time. In short, these early Christians then, because of the good news of what God had done for them in Christ, these early Christians completely renewed their culture. They brought transformation to the very way that people thought, believed, and acted. These Christians worked for justice. And so this morning, it is this issue of justice that I want to look at today because it is a significant part of our five-year vision. Our proposed vision, as we've been talking about over fall, is that we would be a church that is renewing our community through the gospel. That's our proposed vision, renewing our community through the gospel. And today, what I want to show you is that if the gospel, if this good news of what God has done for us in Christ, if this is really working its way down into us, then we, like the early church, will be a people devoted to the cause of justice. Justice in our interpersonal relationships, our workplaces, our city, and beyond that, into the needs of our world. So from our passage today, I want to draw out three things about justice. First of all, we're going to look at the alarming importance of justice. Secondly, the broad meaning of justice. And then finally, the motivational power to actually do justice. Okay? Now, before I get going, I just want to recommend two books to you. The first one is called Good News About Injustice. It's by Gary Haugen. He's the guy who started the organization International Justice Mission, or IJM, that you just watched the video. Our group of churches across Canada are in a partnership with IJM. I'd highly recommend Gary Haugen's book to you. The second is Tim Keller's book, Generous Justice. So I'm going to draw off of both these resources and some others and a sermon that Tim Keller preached along with his book. So I recommend those resources to you. Let's begin by talking about the alarming importance of justice. Now, I use that word alarming on purpose because this first point is going to be exactly that. It's going to be alarming. You'll notice with me in verse 1, if you look at the text, that Isaiah is to cry aloud. He is not to hold back. He is to lift up his voice like a trumpet. A preacher's job is to faithfully expound to the people what God's word says and to illustrate it and apply it to the best of my ability. My job is to show you what this text says and to explain it to you. So if I do my job faithfully this morning, then you and I should feel like Isaiah's hearers felt, namely that a trumpet blast has gone off in our ears, like we are waking up in the middle of the night to the sound of a trumpet in our bedroom. That's why I say this first point is going to be alarming. Let me develop it step by step. Let's look at this text. First thing to notice about this text, quite simply, is it's addressed to God's people. It's not necessarily addressed to all the cultures at large. It's addressed to God's people. If you claim to be a Christian today, this text is for you. The next thing to notice is that God's people are described here as religiously devoted and morally upright. Look with me at how religiously devoted they are. Look at verse 2. It says they delight to draw near to God. They seek him daily, first of all. They seek God daily. That's impressive. They don't just show up to church, you know, one or two Sundays a month. They're there, you know, Saturday. They show up to the synagogue every Saturday. They are committed in their attendance, daily seeking God in prayer, filling their lives with who he is. Look at the end of verse 2. They delight to draw near to God. Look at the beginning of verse 3. They practice fasting. They practice fasting. They're also morally upright. Look again at verse 2. It says, they delight to know my ways. What are God's ways? The way God acts. They want to know that. A little further in the verse 2, it says, they ask of me righteous judgments. So in other words, they want to know what God expects. They want to know how they should act, and they're asking that God would enable them to do what is right. I mean, this sounds to me like a people that are on track. But God says he's not listening to their prayers. says he's not doing it because of their sins. Look at this next step. Back in verse 1, God says that Isaiah is to declare to my people their transgression, to the house of Jacob their sins. So we got to ask, what are these sins? What is this sin that God is so upset about? Answer, his people don't care about justice. They believe the right things. They're devout in their personal piety, reading of the word and prayer and committed to attendance in worship. They believe all the right things. They're very devout, but somehow this makes no difference to the way they relate to the poor, the vulnerable, the weak, those who need help. There's not a connection between these two things. So God rejects their fasting, and then he tells them the kind of fasting that he wants. So look with me at verse 6. It's very clear. Is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? This is very alarming. I've tried to work on a sentence that would capture what this passage is saying. So here's my sentence. If you claim to be in a relationship with God, but are not actively caring for the poor, needy, and oppressed, then you are not pleasing God, no matter how devout and moral you are. It's a long sentence. I had to get a lot in there. If you claim to be in a relationship, you claim to be a Christian, but you are not actively involved in caring for the weak, the vulnerable, the oppressed, if you're not somehow involved in that, then this text seems to be saying you're not pleasing God no matter how devout and moral you are. Now you can question me. Look, is that what the text says? Didn't I walk you through that? These people strive to be devoted. They are moral, and yet God says they've sinned. Why have they sinned? They have not cared for the poor, the underprivileged, and oppressed. It's the same thing if you go back to Isaiah 1. It's actually even a little more harsh. In Isaiah 1, God literally says he hates the worship of his people. He says he hates their sacrifices. He says he will not listen to their prayers. He's got his hands over his ears and he's saying, I will not listen to your prayers. I wish you'd just close the doors to the temple. I wish you'd end your services. I can't stand it anymore. Why does he say that? He says it's because all of their beliefs and their practices are not leading them to care for the weak and the vulnerable. And so in Isaiah 1 verse 17, God says, here's the prescription for you. He says, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, plead the widow's cause. Now, why does God make such a big deal about all this? The answer is because God identifies himself with the poor, with the underprivileged, with the weak. So, to ignore them is to ignore God. To strike at them is to strike at God. This is what we see all through the scriptures. So, think of it this way. When people introduce me, they'll introduce me, for instance, as the husband of Heather. They'll introduce me as the pastor of Central. That's who they identify me as. When God identifies himself, for instance, in Psalm 68, he introduces himself as father of the fatherless and protector of widows. He so closely identifies himself with the fatherless, for instance, that he says, this is who I am. I am the father of the fatherless. That's why Proverbs will put it this way. Proverbs 14:31, whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker. You see that? How is insulting a poor man actually striking at God? It's because God so identifies with the poor man that to strike at him is to strike at God. Or to put it positively, the proverb goes on and says, but he who is generous to the needy honors his maker. Or Proverbs 19:17, again positively put, whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord. See, over and over again, the Bible teaches us that if you claim to be in a relationship with Him, but you're not actively caring for the poor, the needy, or the oppressed, then you're not really in a relationship with Him, no matter how devout and moral you are, because He identifies with this group. So if you're not with them, then you're not with Him. Think of the Pharisees. Let's come to the New Testament. The Pharisees were, of course, the religious conservatives of their day. And Jesus, on one occasion, begins to speak with them, and He begins to identify how religiously devoted they were, and they were. They followed the law so well. And so Jesus says to them, you even tithe, not just on your money. You give 10% of your money, first fruits of it, that's fantastic. Jesus, they go even further. And Jesus says, you even tithe on the herbs that come out of your garden, on mint and dill. They take 10%. I don't know how you do that. You crush up the dill or something, and then you portion off 10%. You see how devoted and particular they were in their religious devotion? Jesus commends them and says, good, you're honoring God for this. But then He says, you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. So in other words, you care so much about these tiny little herbs, but you don't care about issues of justice. Or listen to 1 John 3, verse 17. If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? See that? That's the language I was trying to get about relationship. Little children, John writes, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. Wow. All of this is very alarming. And I think it's particularly alarming to conservative evangelical Christians, most of which make up this church. And as I've been pondering on this, I think there are two reasons why this is so alarming, particularly to conservative Christians. Here's my first reason. I think it's because conservative Christians typically view caring for the poor and doing justice as optional. So in other words, if that's what you're called to, if that's what you're passionate about, then by all means you go and do that. No one's going to stop you. I would never hear that. But, that's not necessarily what I'm about. And so that's why we create a committee to do that for us, if that's where all the people passionate about that go. So we view it as something that's optional. And what really matters in conservative evangelical churches, what's stressed the most, is personal love for God. Your piety is expressed through Bible reading, prayer, and if you're really great, fasting. And then secondly, fulfilling the Great Commission. Isn't that what usually you get told? That's the main tenor of a conservative evangelical church. Love God, fulfill the Great Commission to make disciples of all nations. All right, granted. But let me ask you something. How do we make disciples? Well, Jesus answers the question in the Great Commission. He says you do it two ways. First of all, you baptize all those people who profess faith in Jesus for their salvation. And then secondly, you're to teach them to obey everything that Jesus commanded. And you remember, of course, that Jesus commanded a lot of things, but He said you could put it all under two commands. Love God, love your neighbor. All right, so making disciples means teaching people who become Christians and are baptized to obey particularly the second commandment of loving your neighbor. All right, now the question obviously is, how do you love your neighbor? And Jesus answered that question in the parable of the Good Samaritan. There, Jesus defines it. He says, to love your neighbor means to come to the aid of those who are oppressed and cannot help themselves. For you remember, of course, the Good Samaritan came to the aid of the man who was robbed and beaten and left for dead. To love your neighbor, Jesus says, means to come to the aid of those who have a different ethnic background than you and have religious convictions that are not only different from yours, but maybe opposed to yours. For the Good Samaritan was indeed that, a Samaritan helping a Jew. They were ethnically different, religiously opposite. To love your neighbor, according to that parable, means that you get your hands dirty in helping the oppressed, that you use your time, your money, and your energy to do something about people's needs. For did not the Good Samaritan stop and bandage the man's wounds, got his hands dirty? Did he not then adjust his entire schedule to take the man to an inn, and there he stayed with him the entire night, and then the following day paid for all of his expenses? Even more alarming about the parable of the Good Samaritan is its connection to Isaiah 58. For Jesus actually tells this parable to conservative religious people, the Pharisees, to blast them, saying, if you think that loving God and all that piety and Bible reading and fasting and attendance at feasts and worship services, if you think you can do that and walk right by the man lying on the side of the road, you have not loved your neighbor or me at all. So if we're really going to be about making disciples, then we have to be about teaching people to love their neighbor. And to love their neighbor, according to Jesus, means coming to the aid of those who are vulnerable, who are weak, and who are oppressed. I think there's a second reason that comes to my mind, though, why conservative Christians find this so alarming. And it's this. Conservative Christians find this alarming because social action is typically what liberal churches do. Now, if you grew up, many of you will remember some of these wars of the past generation, and those of you don't, you're the heirs of it anyways. This is the stream you were born into if you're a part of a kind of conservative evangelical church. See, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a great war that went on up to the mid part of the 20th century. Liberal churches came along and they began to deny things like the authority of Scripture, like miracles, like the bodily resurrection of Jesus. They denied the need for personal evangelism and rather gave themselves to social action. In response, there were many Christians, perhaps like Carl F. H. Henry, one of the great figureheads of those who opposed this, who fought to retain the authority of the Scriptures, to retain things like the divinity of Jesus, the bodily resurrection of Jesus, the virgin birth of Jesus, things like the need for evangelism. And Carl F. H. Henry and others stood up against this. One of the sad effects, though, of this great battle is that evangelical conservative Christians began to grow suspicious of any social action as being kind of the slippery slope down to liberalism. And yet, historically speaking, Christians have never separated a high view of the authority of the Word of God, the bodily resurrection of Christ, the need for conversion and evangelism, with social action and caring. I showed you at the beginning, the early church didn't do that. And Carl F. H. Henry didn't do that either. But it's been one of the effects out of the battle that happened between liberal churches and more conservative churches in the mid part of the 20th century. So just to prove that, listen to Carl Henry himself talk about how both evangelism and justice are required. If the church preaches only divine forgiveness and does not affirm justice, she implies that God treats immorality and sin lightly. If the church proclaims only justice, you know, we only do social action, we shall all die in unforgiven sin and without the Spirit's empowerment for righteousness. And here's his concluding sentence. We should be equally troubled that we lag in championing justice and in fulfilling our evangelistic mandates. There is one of the great figureheads saying, we must do both. So let me restate the point for emphasis. If we claim to be in a relationship with God, but are not actively caring for the poor, the oppressed, and the needy, then we are not pleasing God, no matter how devout and moral we are. Is that alarming? Is that not a trumpet blast within the sleeping crowds of conservative churches? Do you find that alarming? I do. So with that in mind then, now let's build on that and let's come to the second point. If doing justice is so important, which we've just tried to establish, then now we have to ask the question, what is justice? How do we actually do this? And so in the second place now, let's talk about the broad meaning of justice. I think this passage will draw out for us three things about what justice is. Here's the first one. Justice means equal treatment for all people. Equal treatment for all people. Now, that you might just say, that's so obvious. Of course, I know that. Everybody believes that, don't they? No, they don't, actually. This is what Hurtado is trying to show and what many have shown. In the history of the world, this is not the case, and it's not necessarily the case around the world today. The history of the world is things like superior nations crushing little nations. It's the weak being destroyed by the strong. It's men oppressing women. It's one ethnicity trying to destroy another simply because of their ethnicity. It is the rich oppressing the poor. This is not a given. And if it's a given to you, it's again because you are the heir of a Christian tradition that has not yet been wiped out of Western culture. But the Bible teaches, you see, that all people are made in God's image, and therefore all people are worthy of dignity and respect. So look with me, for instance, at verse 7. I mean, just see an example of it here. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house when you see the naked to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Now that phrase, homeless poor, what that actually is referring to is immigrants or refugees, those who had come into Israel who didn't have a place to stay. And so when a refugee came in, they were to be cared for. So God's people then were to give equal treatment. Leviticus has laws for this. Equal treatment, not just for their own tribe, for their own people, but also for the alien, for the refugee, for the immigrant who was among them. This was a radical notion in ancient times. And I still think it's a bit radical today. It didn't matter if those people had a different ethnic background. It didn't matter if they worshipped Baal or other gods. God's people were to take them in and to show them kindness. And friends, what a joy it has been to be a part of this church over this past year, where we raised, I think it was almost $43,000 to bring over our family from Sudan, and now to continue to care for them. What a joy that has been. Well done, Central. That is an act of justice in a world where there is need. So justice means that, first of all, at a baseline, it means equal treatment for all people, not just looking out for your own. Secondly, justice means special concern for vulnerable populations. Special concern for vulnerable populations. Have you ever noticed as you read the Bible, constantly it will speak, we've already referenced it, about widows and orphans. Speak up for them, the Bible says. Well, why? Why not speak up for men? Why not speak up for children who have parents? I mean, this isn't equal treatment. This is actually special treatment, the Bible's saying here, if we're supposed to speak up for them. Why would we do that and not speak up for men and children who have parents? Well, is the answer not obvious? It's because typically men can speak for themselves. And typically, children who have parents have those who can speak for them. But of course, orphans don't have anyone to speak for them. My slide's up a little early. We'll get to that one in just a second. Everyone's like, what are we doing? We'll get there. One more verse before we get to that. This is why Proverbs 31 says, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Speak for the rights of all who are destitute. In other words, for those who have no power to speak, you are to be their voice. We see this in verse 8. What a marvelous verse this is. Verse 8 says, Verse 6, sorry. Is this not the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? All right, now we'll get that slide up there. A yoke is a beam that was strapped over oxen. It holds the animals in place so they cannot move, so that they'll stay in line as they are tracking the ground that they're going to be digging up. God says, wicked people put yokes around the necks of other people. And what this verse is saying is that wherever people are treated like animals, God's people are to work to undo the straps that hold them within that yoke so that they are free. But more than that, notice at the end of it, it doesn't say just to undo the straps. That's a short-term solution. You free them from that. They're also to work on long-term projects, for is that not what it says at the end? They are to break every yoke. You are, as God's people, to work on any social structure, any societal norm, any culture in which wicked people treat others like animals with yokes that they put upon them. You are to come along and break those yokes. International Justice Mission, or IJM, is an excellent example of an agency that you can partner with, that we as a fellowship of evangelical Baptist churches partner with. What they do is they rescue victims of slavery, trafficking, sexual exploitation, and other forms of violent oppression. I was reading a story of theirs this week. It was telling about a 14-year-old girl whom they just called Panita. She had accepted a job in a city. She wanted to provide for her family, and the family was in a desperate place, so she accepted this job, went to the city. But it was a trap. The man that had promised her the job captured her, and he sold her to a brothel. IJM then worked with local authorities to gather evidence, which prompted a raid on the brothel. Panita, thankfully, was rescued before her first sexual assault, but there were 95 other sexual trafficked victims who had been there for some time. Justice means special concern for vulnerable populations. And there's a lot of vulnerable populations. It's estimated that there are 170 million orphans in the world today. That's only the ones that they can count. They can't count street children and those who are in rural areas that they can't find. 170 million kids without parents. There are issues, of course, vulnerable populations like that happen in abusive child labor practices, in child pornography, in violence against people because of their ethnicity. And we could go on and on and on about vulnerable populations. But that's what justice means. And finally, justice means a life of generosity. We see this in verse 7. Verse 7 says, "Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house, when you see the naked to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh?" Verse 10 is even clearer. Look at verse 10. God's going to do all these for them if you pour yourself out for the hungry. Pour yourself out for the hungry. Or a little bit further down, right below that, satisfy the desire of the afflicted. This clearly means using your wealth, but it's so much more than that. To pour yourself out is about time. I like that phrase, to not hide yourself from your own flesh. That is, from your own family and the needs that they may have. So you think about things like caring for aging parents. That's an act of justice. To put yourself out there, these verses clearly show us then that justice is not an optional thing. It's not an optional thing if you're to pour yourself out. That's not just like an occasional thing. It's a constant thing. Justice, therefore, means these three things: equal treatment for all people, special concern for vulnerable populations, and a life of generosity that seeks the well-being of others. All right, who's feeling overwhelmed? Feel a little overwhelmed when you think about this trumpet that has just woken us from our sleep. It's disturbing. And now we've been told what we are to do. This is what justice looks like. And then we can feel overwhelmed as we think about all the needs in the world and all that can be done. And we can start feeling guilty about all that. And so this is where sermons can sometimes end. All right, I've told you to do it. I've told you what it looks like to do it. Now go do it. But here's the problem. First of all, there's so many needs out there that I don't know about you, but I often get paralyzed into inactivity. You think so many needs, you'd be throwing yourself in, but somehow what we do is we get paralyzed into inactivity by the sheer amount of issues. But then also there's our hearts. Our hearts know we should do something, but then we don't always do what we know we should do. And that's why we need the third point. In the third place, let's talk about the motivational power to do justice. The motivational power to do justice. This passage shows us what will and what will not motivate you to do justice. First of all, what will not? What will not motivate God's people to act more justly is simply being told that this is one more duty that you must fulfill. I've already told you that. You can see clearly the duty of believers to do this in this text. I don't know how we can escape that. but duty doesn't seem to change our hearts. These people were already fulfilling all kinds of religious duties. So just doing more religious duties is not somehow going to change our hearts. These people were very religious. I mean, they fasted. Did you fast this week? When's the last time you fasted? So these people are very religiously devoted. Duty will motivate to a point, but duty often does not last because it does not come from a renewed heart. It comes from a heart that says, that's the law I need to obey. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't do it long term. So here's the key. The Bible always tells us our duty. We don't want to downplay that. We don't want to downplay the law. The Bible tells us what we are to do, but it doesn't always just seek to motivate us through duty. It also motivates us through delight. You see, delight does what duty cannot. Let me just show you this in everyday life. You will be easily motivated to act on things that you find beautiful, captivating, that you delight in. You will act on them, give time and money towards them because your heart is motivated, right? Let's just think of some easy examples. I went to one of my years of college, I take music history 101. And so we had to learn all of, you know, Mozart's pieces and all this kind of stuff. I had to memorize this and we had to, you know, take it. So why would we do that? Well, maybe to take an exam, to pass the grade so we could get a job and earn money, you know, if you track it all the way down. It was a duty thing, listen to Mozart. But then you finish college and maybe you start to discover that there's some beauty in Mozart. And now you use the money you make from your job to go out and spend it on Mozart's music so you can delight in listening to it and enjoying it. So you see how delight does for me what duty could not. My teacher told me I had to listen to Mozart. My mom told me I had to listen to Mozart. But I didn't really discover Mozart until I was older. And now there's a delight in my heart to listen to Mozart. Or if you're not a music person, let's change the analogy a little bit. How many of you, when you were younger and you were in phys ed class, you just hated phys ed class? You know, the teacher's just making you run, and you know, your teacher could tell you all the reasons you needed to do it, to be healthy and all this kind of stuff, and that was duty. You should do this because I said so. You didn't like sports, though. But then maybe you grow up and you began to appreciate sports, maybe even just watching sports. Maybe you can't play sports, but there's something about sports, if you're a sports person, that you are captivated by what athletes can do. And so you're just amazed. And so you will gladly give time and money to enjoy sports. You're easily motivated because delight has transformed duty. Or just take reading. You know, you grew up reading. Your teacher told you need to learn to read. Why do you need to learn to read? Because you need to be able to be educated so you can grow up and get a job so that you can earn money and you can live. It was duty. But then, you know, as you grow older, you start to discover, or speaking for myself anyways, the joy of reading. And so now I take the money I earn from my job because I have so much delight, I want to buy books so that I can read them and find delight in them. You see what I'm saying with all this? Delight transforms duty. Delight is far more powerful as a motivator than duty. And this is what the Bible is always doing for us. This is what the good news always does. It takes the duties that God has given us, and it says, all right, here's the duties, you not need to do them, but then it transforms them into delight. Here's the examples. You can see it right here in this passage, because pouring oneself out for justice, if it's just duty, let me just track this. If you only do this for duty, you'll only do the bare minimum. You'll give a few dollars to ease your conscience, but it will not be a big part of your life. But if you see justice as something that is delightful, that your heart is captured by it, you'll joyfully and easily give time and wealth to it. And here in Isaiah 58, we see that God seeks to motivate his people. First of all, he tells them the duties, but then he seeks to motivate them through delight. Over and over again, God puts pictures of beauty, of something that will captivate. He gives them future examples of renewal. He puts them all before their eyes so they will do what he said. You want to track these quickly with me? Look at verse 8. Then, if you do all this, then shall your light break forth like the dawn. You'll come out of the darkness, you'll be like the sun rising with the light, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you, the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. You see this? He's setting an example of beauty before them. Look at verse 9. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, here I am. So the God who wasn't listening to their prayers before, if they start doing justice, God's saying, if you're those kind of people, I am going to run to you and I'm going to say, what are your requests? The Almighty Maker of heaven and earth will be having a keen ear to your prayers. And this kind of language just goes on and on. Look at verse 11. And the Lord will guide you continually. He'll lead your life. He will satisfy your desire in scorched places and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters do not fail. And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. Then even just flip down to verse 14. Then you shall take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth. You see, God is motivating them with delight. This is what you will receive. It's a powerful picture of beauty. But friends, when we get to the New Testament, we get a far more captivating and beautiful picture of justice. From the New Testament, we learn that God himself became poor. That God did not stand afar when there was all this injustice in the world, when human beings were lost in their sin, enslaved to sin and Satan and death. He did not stand afar and not do anything about it. No. God himself became a man in the person of Jesus Christ. The Son of God took on flesh, and he was not born in a palace. He was born in a manger. He was born to a lower middle-income family. His parents could only offer at the temple the basic of sacrifices. He grew up, and he says later on, he had no place even to lay his head. When he entered Jerusalem, he had to borrow a donkey. He had to borrow a room, rent a room in order to celebrate the Passover with his disciples. But more than that, Jesus, the Son of God, knew what it meant to face injustice. Just ponder on this for a moment. Jesus, the creator of all, the king of all, was put on trial. And his trial was an utter miscarriage of justice. He was falsely accused. Then he was tortured. And then the innocent Son of God was brutally murdered. He was oppressed by the powers that be. He was put under their thumb and crushed by them. And yet the scriptures tell us that this story is good news for us, for Jesus, the Son of God, voluntarily did this on our behalf. Jesus voluntarily faced the condemnation that came to him and took upon himself our condemnation that we deserve so that we then could be pardoned and go free. Jesus, the innocent one, faced condemnation so that we, the condemned, could receive pardon. He did all of this. He faced the injustice to solve all the problems of justice. And so listen, the story of Christianity then is unique. Through his death, Jesus loosed those bonds of wickedness that held us fast. Through his death and his resurrection, he unstrapped the yoke of condemnation. Through his death and resurrection, he broke the power of death. You see, the God of Christianity is not a God who stands afar while injustice occurs. Christianity, in fact, is the only religion in the world that speaks of a God who knows what it means to be beaten, to be tortured, to be oppressed, and to face injustice. So this message of Christianity is unique then because Jesus came into the world to make all the wrongs right. And of course, the story ends with Jesus returning one day to bring full justice upon this earth. That's the good news of Christianity. Now, when that good news begins, when you begin to see, I was the criminal, but I've been freed. When you begin to see, he justified me when I was ungodly. That good news begins to change you. And one of the things it does is it transforms the way you look upon injustice and the way you respond to it. One of the greatest examples of this course comes from William Wilberforce. If you don't know much of your history, that is a man you need to get to know. He, of course, is the man who almost is single-handedly responsible for ending the African slave trade and slavery itself in the 1800s, well, late 1700s, early 1800s. But do you know what motivated Wilberforce? You don't need to take my word for it. He wrote a book called A Practical View of Christianity. You can actually read the PDF online. He wrote a book explaining his agenda, and he says, "What motivates me is the doctrine of justification by faith alone in Christ alone." In other words, the gospel. He was blatant about this, and he said, "The problem with England," he said, "is you all claim to be Christians, you all have this piety and this devotion and this morality, but you've disconnected it from the gospel. So you've lost these great doctrines of justification by faith, and therefore it's not impacting how you should think about the slaves." And so he attacked his fellow English people, and he sought to revive the good news of Jesus Christ, because he said, "When the good news comes into you, it changes you in such a way that you will act on in the cause of things like ending slavery." And that's exactly what happened. That's world level. Let's go down a little more personal level. I'll share a personal story. This is really what also motivated Heather and I to pursue and actually do our adoption of our son Josh, who comes from Kunming, China. Heather and I actually had never thought really about adoption, I'll be honest with you. We had three biological children of our own. This was not even really on our radar at all. But we were beginning to search the scriptures and on these type of things, and I was praying. I was like, "Lord, I don't know how to go about this life of justice. Would you please show me? What should we do?" And we tried a few different things, and they weren't quite connecting with where we were at. One day I was out for a run and I was listening to a sermon, and the sermon was on the doctrine of adoption, that is, how in Jesus Christ, God the Father has freed us from slavery, and not only that, he has brought us home to his house, adopted us as his children, and made us full heirs within his house. And the preacher was stressing the great love of the Father for us. He was stressing the cost of our adoption. And he was stressing just how much the Father has a personal and a particular love for each of his children. I was out for a long run that day, and I actually just stopped my run. I could run no longer, as my heart was absolutely overwhelmed with God the Father's personal and particular love for me. I just, you know, out on this road, it was actually in a campground, out on this road, just stopped with tears streaming down my face and my hands like this, "Praise you, Jesus, oh, praise." I just totally overwhelmed with the Father's love for me, and immediately began to make these connections between the doctrine of adoption and actually adopting children. And so began to talk with Heather, and of course it's a long process, but eventually we adopted our son Josh. But see, what compelled us, what changed us, was not just a sense of duty, it was delight. It was such a delight in the Father's adopting love for me that it changed the way I looked upon orphans in the world, and I said, just as God the Father acted and it cost him something to do this, I want to act and make it cost me something to do this. John Newton, of course, the author of the famous hymn Amazing Grace, also a mentor of William Wilberforce's, he wrote not just Amazing Grace, he actually wrote thousands of other hymns. And in one of them, he captures what I'm trying to get at here. Listen to these two verses. In this hymn, he sings, "Our pleasure and our duty, though opposite before, since we have seen his beauty, are joined to part no more. To see the law by Christ fulfilled and hear his pardoning voice transforms a slave into a child and duty into choice." You might have to meditate on that for a bit. There you have it. There are many ways you can fulfill Isaiah 58. It, of course, begins with just acting justly in your everyday relationships. It doesn't have to be global level type things. Employees acting justly, employers acting justly, justly within your family, justly within your neighborhoods. And then it, of course, it extends to your city and to your world. And as I mentioned before, I think one of the great problems in our internet age and this kind of stuff is we kind of get like overwhelmed by the needs of this world. And it can paralyze us into inaction. Here's my suggestion to you. to simply go on your knees and pray to God and say, what's one or two areas where I can be involved? Pray about it and then see where the Lord begins to lead your heart. Perhaps it's, you know, sponsoring a child or something. In 2 weeks, Central is sending Heather and I to Ecuador on a trip with Compassion Canada, an organization that we're thinking about partnering with here at Central, so we'll report back to you on that. Compassion Canada is kind of like World Vision, and it does some other things as well, but the thing is like sponsoring children who are in poverty. So that you, maybe it's sponsoring children. Maybe it's supporting an organization like IJM. Perhaps it's doing local ministry right around here with our place up the block or with our breakfast club or George J. Elementary or all these other ministries that Central Baptist Church is involved in right here in the downtown core. But whatever it is, maybe it's speaking for the unborn, volunteering in a crisis pregnancy center. Maybe it is assisting the handicapped, confronting racism, caring for the elderly. There's so many ways this can be done. My challenge to you today is to go home and to begin to pray about that. May we be a church as we move forward. May we be a church so filled with the good news of Jesus Christ and all that God has done in acting on our behalf when we were the ones in slavery, that we in turn would act in the cause of justice. Let's pray. As we're praying, I invite those who are helping serve the Lord's Supper to come to the front. As we come to the Lord's Supper, I want us to just take a moment to examine our hearts and maybe whatever God is speaking to you about this morning. Pray to Him, seek Him. Whatever is on your heart, let it be led into prayer right now with God as we come to celebrate this table which points to the death of Christ.